Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, Poppy Booth, Eloise Sheehan and Alex Levchuk, travelling across the decades to consider the impact of popular cult TV and film on the universe.
The Anthony Wilson Factor, Paranoia, Then and Now, The Fugitive, Bakersfield and Kinney, and the classic question, Bud's Diner or Kelly's Diner? All aspects which will be considered in this week's episode of Resonance Rewind, The Invaders. So there we are, the only original material that was written by Dominic Frontiere for The Invaders, because the rest of the soundtrack was taken from The Outer Limits. There we are. It's all very strange and wonderful. And Robin, as you obviously are friends with Gary Girani, I think you could probably actually give the wonderful, almost Twitter-esque summary of The Invaders' first season episode, the pilot episode, because it is actually worth noting that if you watch this on YouTube, you might have got extra bonus features. If you watch the unaired pilot, you've got extra bonus features, which you wouldn't have actually got if you watched the original transmitted version. But there you are. Over to you, Robin.
Well, Gary Girani, in his book Fantastic Television, tells us, Beachhead, from the first season, 1967, it's actually the pilot for The Invaders, and the synopsis is, David Vincent desperately searches for someone who will believe he sighted the landing of a spaceship. And, okay, that sounds very, very kind of sparse, but it really does sum up the whole episode. And indeed, the whole series.
Well, the summation in terms of IMDb, architect David Vincent, too long without sleep, takes a side road in search of coffee, but Bud's Diner is closed, and so Vincent does the only thing he can, settles in for a nap. An hour later at 5 a.m., actually, I think it was around about 4:20 a.m., a ruddy glow awakens him. He sees the very unexpected, a space vessel landing nearby. Vincent then rushes off and the series commences. Now, Jessica, when I actually saw the town of Kinney, it reminded me so much of your description of your hometown in North Carolina. Is it the same sort of area of sparseness that they've actually got there, which apart from the Ackerman girls and Mr. Kemper and maybe one or two police officers, that's it really?
It's not quite that tiny here, but it is still the same little everybody knows everybody feel we have. Very quaint.
Of course, the question is, do you really know everybody? Because that's what the series plays on, the whole notion of paranoia. Very much the aspect of looking to scare people from the off. We'll come to you first then, Jessica. What did you make of this initial pilot for a series which lasted 1.5 seasons, really, The Invaders?
I thought it was very good. I think I must have been scarred by E.T. as a kid or something, because aliens are one of the things that just freaks me out for some reason. So I was like, I watched this at night and I like had to lock the doors because I got so like freaked out. So I actually had fun with it. I thought it was very, very good. It was frustrating that no one believed him, but it was good.
It's especially when you actually have Grandma from the Waltons played by Ellen Corby, with again the hands trying to actually arrange her glasses with the fingers sort of pointing out there. It's very difficult. It's an early PlayStation thumb. It was on the back clearly of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the whole notion of the Red Menace, the Red Scare, the fact that people just like us can be undermining us. maybe if we're looking for resonance today, viruses are just like us. They take over, and before we know where we are, suddenly we've been invaded. And it's that paranoia that comes across. Now, speaking of paranoia, I'm fairly well certain that Eloise Sheehan, not necessarily suffering from paranoia, but Jack, her faithful cat, who's already given a score for this episode, probably because he was taken by the Ackerman girls, and why not? So what did you make of this particular aspect?
I really liked it. I was a bit confused by the finger thing at the beginning. I thought maybe they were just very posh aliens. My cat, however, was absolutely staring at it the entire time and did not take his eyes off the screen, so he very much appreciates the show.
The lines, a Quinn Martin production, for me, echo Canon, Streets of San Francisco, FBI, The Fugitive, of course, which this was built on the back of. And it's interesting that one of the reasons there was not, spoiler alert, a concluding episode to The Invaders, unlike The Fugitive, was because although The Fugitive with David Janssen had huge audience figures for its final episode, because syndication was the buzzword in the 60s, 70s, and indeed 80s, they really wanted to leave the series open-ended. And that probably led to a lot of guest stars reappearing and maybe a sense of a lack of continuity, a lack of things which maybe could have actually been addressed and developed a little bit further. I mean, most of the characters we actually see portrayed in this pilot episode reappear in the series, but as other characters, not themselves as well. Jenny, I knew you were particularly taken with Bud's diner, because clearly your advice would be, why didn't he just take the train as opposed to actually driving all that distance and so on? But what did you make of the episode?
I do really like The Invaders. Being old, as I've said before, I have seen the whole series before. And although it's not action-packed, and the premise of it is really the same every week, that he's just trying to convince people that the invaders are here. But I love the music. I love the era. I like the way the Quinn Martin, where they have the act 1, 2, 3, 4, the epilogue, the voiceover, the way they introduce the guests. I just like the whole format, and I think the acting in this is very good, and I've always really enjoyed this series very much.
It's interesting, Roy Thinnes got a lot of flack for basically being unemotional and hardly smiling. Well, actually, given the sort of stresses and strains he's under, it's not necessarily a barrel of laughs, really.
When you're an architect, though, that's your demeanour.
Yeah, I've known a few architects and they have been known to smile, although those that did smile actually have now deceased, so maybe there's something in that. I won't go there. Robin, we were talking about Anthony Wilson. I mentioned Anthony Wilson in the opening sequence there. He obviously was responsible for putting a lot into this particular episode, which again has Outer Limits precedence. He also came up with a character for Dr. Zachary Smith in Lost in Space, and was responsible for making all the characters on Land of the Giants apparently three-dimensional in terms of his work. He also developed Planet of the Apes for television, another series which was kind of people on the run, two astronauts and a chimpanzee, which we'll look at later. How did you feel the writing actually bore up in this episode? Did it kind of echo that sense of paranoia that...
I think that on this particular episode, both yourself and Jenny have basically taken my best material that I had ready. So shame on both of you. I first saw this when it was rerun on BBC Two in the mid-1980s. And it starts off quite strongly with Beachhead. The trouble is, it doesn't get that much further. He is always going to be on the run. At that point, I'd read a lot, particularly in Fantastic Television and Starburst, that it built quite a bit on The Fugitive, which I didn't recollect watching, but I remember seeing the last episode when it was first shown. I've got the DVD box set of The Fugitive, and it's a far, far better series. Mm. And I think it's because it all hinges on a number of things.
A one-armed man, for instance.
Sorry?
A one-armed man.
Well, you've got a character on the run. Now, in order to keep the series going, he needs to stay on the run. So he's just going to have a different adventure every week, which is pretty much the same as every other adventure, because the aliens know who he is. He knows who the aliens are. The aliens know that he knows that they're there. He knows that the aliens know that he is, and so on and so forth. Now, paranoia, I mean, that worked quite well in Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the 50s sci-fi series that I love so much. But as a weekly TV series, it gets threadbare very quickly. And what would have worked well during, you know, McCarthyism and the red under the bed really didn't float that well during the Summer of Love, did it? So I think it was too little, too late. And Roy Thinnes, and I've seen him subsequently in, I think he was in a horror movie with William Shatner called Horror at 37,000 Feet, about, you know, the exorcist aboard an airplane. Seen him in Battlestar Galactica, Gun on Ice Planet Zero, and of course Journey to the Far Side of the Earth from Gerry Anderson. But he seems to not act. He is that sort of pod person from you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I mean, if anything, he's more alien than the aliens are.
Harsh words from Rob there.
But well earned, I feel.
Clearly, you're just bitter because you weren't able to receive BBC television in the 1960s, because otherwise you would have remembered watching it on a Saturday night for the first season, and then it was actually screened at a very odd time. It ended up being screened, I think, on a late Saturday evening, about sort of 11 o'clock, and all sort of Friday night later. But so then, of course, it was rerun, as you rightly said. Bud's Diner, actually named for Quinn Martin production manager Bud Brill. So we put that to rest at this particular stage. I thought there was a wonderful case of police brutality from Sheriff Carver, who obviously, when he re-encounters David, having just found that his best friend has been killed, whacks him over the head with a torch. But that's perhaps an early sort of thing. Jessica, returning to yourself, I mean, industry, the sense of middle America being bought out, big opportunist systems coming into place, the sense of genuine, a biblical David against the Goliath of nobody believes what's happening. Were those things that you felt still resonated today with you?
Oh, definitely. I think especially too with the town, how it was kind of being bought out and kind of becoming more corporate. I think that that's definitely happening more and more, where kind of corporations are coming into places that are very small and just kind of taking over. It's happening here as well.
And nobody believes you, Jess. This is the whole thing. Don't worry.
Can I just ask a question here, just for a second?
Yeah.
Now, we know he has abnormally small hands, but has anybody seen Donald Trump move his little finger? Just asking for a friend.
Of course. It's funny how a man's life can change so fast. Since the night I saw the saucer, it seems as though little segments have been passing in all sorts of ways. I mean, there are suggestions, of course, that I mean, apart from obviously Grandma from the Waltons, as I refer to obviously Ellen Corby's character as Aunt Sarah, who keeps cropping up. First of all, she's the person who may have actually started the fire that Vincent effectively manages to put out, and that's the first attempt that the aliens make to silence him. Then, of course, we see her give the wrong directions to David's friend when he goes off to investigate the sounds from War of the Worlds that are actually being used to sort of echo the essence of the alien system. I mean, Eloise, back with yourself, were there areas here that you kind of, like Jessica, found still echoed across the decades? Because, I mean, we're talking about over 50 years, obviously, since it was first produced.
To be honest, I thought it was quite good for its time, especially the fire sequence. Does anyone know how that was filmed? That looked incredibly realistic. And if that was realistic, that was really dangerous, because that did not look like that had been made for a TV set.
Well, as we found out from one of our other regular midweek drivettes, Jean Bruce Scott, even in the 1980s when she was on Airwolf, she was still actually being asked to do stunts and things that technically could have killed her. So I think we can say that they certainly go for a certain amount of realism within the sequence. Plus, of course, I'm never really sure whether actually trying to put out a fire with your jacket is the best way forward, but that's a different line. Or a rug. J.D. Cannon, of course, known for his role as a sidekick in MacLeod, could, in theory, have actually been seen as an alien himself, because we have that classic line that, you know, let it end here. Let this be the end of the whole sequence. And he's never really a fan of Vincent. I mean, were there kind of ambiguous characters that, from your own point of view, Jenny, also added to the enjoyment of the show?
Yes, I think it's a typical human trait, really, that anybody that's a little bit off the wall or has any unusual ideas, that everybody sort of treats them a bit like they're bonkers or they're a leper or something like that. And it's also in this, you've got the fact that every single character that comes into the program, you're thinking to yourself, well, are they human or are they alien? You see, so you're doubting everybody. And I almost think that David Vincent needed to learn to doubt everybody, and also maybe not be quite so outspoken in his things, because obviously everybody's just going to think he's crackers.
But one of the lines which I thought was quite interesting, and again echoes with an awful lot of tragedies that we see almost repeated endlessly throughout the world, is again the line of Aunt Sarah. What a shame, she said. He looked and talked so normal. You just never know.
Exactly.
And actually, that is at the heart of the classic line, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Yep.
Which actually, from addressing your point, Robin, almost goes back to that line that, you know, actually, week in, week out, you're going to face that whole challenge. I mean, next week, we're looking at a series which is celebrating 50 years since it effectively launched itself through the process. And again, lots of paranoia there with Shadow, the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization. If only David Vincent had made contact with Ed Bishop's Commander Straker, it could have been a whole new
one. You know, UFO was set in 1980, so, you know, he was too far away. But as David Vincent met these invaders every week, and most of them were hostile, but then again, they were being greeted with hostility. A couple of them were seen as benign, but there was an awful lot of aliens out there, weren't there? Now, David Vincent being...
There's an awful lot of coronavirus out there as well, Robin.
My point is, David Vincent being basically an emotionless cipher in a world full of aliens, who really is the alien here?
Nice point.
Good point.
The closing line of, again, the police inspector, this is the final word, Vincent, the bottom line, for your own sake, let it end here. Whatever you're planning, let it end here. And then echoing Kathy's line, Kathy Adams, about don't go, don't fight us. You know, that whole sort of system. I mean, Jessica, is that almost, again, it's almost straight from Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the notion of pod people, that actually, no matter how much you might try to resist, ultimately, there is a sense that the takeover will take place. Is that something that, that concerns yourself in North Carolina, for instance?
I guess, yeah, it's kind of, I thought it was interesting kind of how you were saying where it seemed inevitable what he was trying to fight against just was never going to be able to be stopped. And I feel like that was kind of my problem with the show a little bit, was that I felt like it left no room for him to go any further with stopping them. It kind of brought all the action really early. And I guess that can translate to real life. I think how you brought up the Cold War scare, the Red Scare, was very true. And I think it's kind of still here in different ways, especially with the upcoming election. People are kind of a little bit suspicious of each other. And even with COVID, people are always just like, oh, do they have it? You know, you never know if someone's going to show it.
It certainly magnified that whole process through. Apparently, Kinney in reality is the town of Tenecula, which again, I have no awareness of, but apparently it also has vineyards and resort hotels. Obviously, Bakersfield is still in existence in California, and beware of any hydroelectric power stations or trucks that are coming out from that point of view. The notion of Kinney to Bakersfield control, emergency, Kinney to Bakersfield control, was very impressive.
Thank you.
Robin, any closing thoughts you'd like to offer in terms of the Invaders?
I think it would have benefited from some character development on behalf of David Vincent, because they introduced him as Architect David Vincent. It didn't really matter that he was an architect, did it? We didn't know any more about him in the final episode than we knew at the first episode. Now, to compare that with next week's UFO, over the series, we actually got to know quite a bit of Ed Straker's background, but we didn't know anything about David Vincent. I mean, the only other TV show that really deliberately kept everybody as anonymous as David Vincent was Mission Impossible. You know, which was at about the same time. But that was more necessary because these were just ciphers on black op missions every week. But with Vincent, we would have cared more about him if we knew more about him. And if he'd have been likable.
I think you've been a little bit harsh there. I think you, to the extent of how Roy Thinnes actually developed in terms of this, and I think in terms of his portrayal, I think it was perfectly acceptable given the challenges he was faced with and so on, and his character was faced with. Eloise, closing thoughts from yourself.
Compared to the other shows that we have watched, I do think that it was one of the most realistic ones we have seen. I know obviously it's science fiction and aliens, but the one that I could see most happening in real life, I did feel necessarily sorry for him, that no one believed him, and that is exactly what would happen. No one would be on his side if that actually occurred today. So.
We haven't spoken, of course, about Mr. Kemper, who I thought was obviously the last holdout, according to Mrs. Adams there. Or was he just sort of insisting on actually giving non-PC looks and a Laura Mulvey sense to the Ackerman girls as they're actually doing their boogieing, twisting exercises, which, you know, clearly obviously led to Vincent having to do what Robin did last week and actually physically forcibly unplug his electrical power. Because presumably, Robin, the case that can be revealed now is you didn't want any noises going out in case somebody was visiting you in Wales at that stage. It's all right.
There we go.
Jenny, any final thoughts from yourself?
I think I would say that it's sort of a human nature trait that it doesn't matter how much we're up against, we always keep on fighting. And I think that's a little bit of the theme of the programme, that, you know, even though he looks like he's an idiot and nobody believes him, he just keeps on going. And I think that's very much human nature.
As we haven't really talked about Larry Cohen, of course, who was, I don't think he did a great deal other than the series, but clearly once he'd actually moved on to this, I think he'd originally sold it as a kind of setup to the prisoner and then said to move on. And we obviously, it was interesting.
Did he become a film producer?
Yes, he did Cue the Winged Serpent.
Cue the Winged Serpent and one or two other areas. And The Stuff. Mm. And, goodness me, It's Alive.
But again, none of those things necessarily had the kind of impact that perhaps he'd hoped that they would have. Jessica, closing thoughts for yourself.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed it. I think that we've all kind of had a moment where we're trying to convince someone that something really did happen and they don't believe us. Maybe not quite about, you know, aliens, but I think we can all kind of relate to the feeling of just someone not believing us and we're trying so hard to convince them.
And just out of interest, to actually sort of ease my own paranoia, did we watch the expanded episode, which is the hour slot via YouTube, in which you do get to see David Vincent in his architect's office actually drawing the design for the invading or the spaceship that he actually saw? Or did you actually miss out that part? Because again, I think it's interesting, having watched both, you certainly get more character input in terms of the expanded original pilot that was unaired. I don't know whether which one did you see, Robin? Because this could be critical to your understanding of the piece.
Which one do you think? I watched the broadcast version the Believers box set. The Complete Invaders.
In which case, and Jenny, what about yourself?
I watched the original pilot on DVD, the series one.
Yeah, so again, you won't have seen him working as an architect.
No, I didn't know it was on YouTube. It's just I wanted to actually sit and watch it properly matter? On a
did
big
screen. Did it make a difference?
Actually, I think it does. It adds a lot of the sort of issues that you talked about. There's even a wonderful sequence with Aunt Sarah and David Vincent where Aunt Sarah says, I'm just like you. People don't believe me either. And they're very nice, these aliens. They're little, they're small and nice. And that, again, opens up another range of other sort of aspects. A bit like E.T., of course, which, Jessica, we're obviously going to have to review your notions of E.T. phone home. So let's
wait till Jessica sees UFO.
just don't go there at this particular stage, because again, it's going to be an online experience for a show which, as I say, is celebrating 50 years since it officially launched, and opened up a whole range of things. But again, think of a world in which the Earth is still there, the Moon is still there, because it's 19 years before it's blown out of the Earth's orbit. Purple hairstyles are very much in fashion if you head to the Moon, and indeed wing-based cars and Nehru suits are clearly what is happening in this version of the multiverse, which happens to be Andersonville in the 1980s. But we're down to scores. So Eloise, what is your score out of 10 for Beachhead, the opening episode of The Invaders?
Considering I did actually watch the extended one, I did quite like it and did quite like the main character. So I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
There we are, my case in point in terms of watch the extended version as opposed to the broadcast version, and you see a whole new world. Jessica, what about yourself?
I think probably a 7 out of 10. I think I just got a little overwhelmed with everything that was going. There was a lot in that. There was the whole mental hospital, that somebody died. There was a lot going on. it was fun.
And as we've said, aliens as virus. We know that Jack actually has given a 7 out of 10 for this. That's obviously Eloise's feline friend, who's Jack's obviously stepped in for Poppy, who's unable to actually join us today. Jenny, what about yourself?
I apologise to Robin, but I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 because I absolutely love it.
I'm going 8.5 because, again, I feel for all the reasons we've actually sort of said, there are one or two areas, and I can understand Robin's piece if he's just seen one or two things in isolation, that actually the more you kind of look through the process to see what they're doing, actually it does stand up as a really well-made piece of narrative and storytelling. But Robin, I suspect you're probably going to be around about the 5.5 to 6 mark, really.
Well, actually, I have seen both seasons throughout on that rerun. So I know that, you know, if you've seen the pilot, you've seen the whole thing. It doesn't get any better than that.
I disagree, Robin. You've got my
question. Well.
There were the Believers, okay, with Kent Smith, but, you know, okay. I don't dislike it, but it could have been better. I would have preferred it if it had been made 10 years earlier and in black and white. I'm going to give it a 6.
Well, I watched it originally in black and white.
And
I think it stands into place with that. That's okay. I think it's again, watch both versions and appreciate it. We may return to it sometime in the not too distant future. If, of course, the aliens haven't actually quite sorted things out and they haven't sort of taken us over completely, because, you know, who knows what could actually happen from that point of view. That's it then for another edition of Resonance Rewind. Keep resonating with the world, which is our particular line, I think we've sat on from that point of view. And as we said, next week, UFO, unidentified flying object, the first scenario, which is curiously called identified, is going to be the line that we're actually be taking. So let's hope we're all together from that point of view, and we'll return.